You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, January 24th, 2023. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ken Klippenstein, investigative reporter at The Intercept, author of his self-titled newsletter on Substack. Will be talking to us about the five creepiest moments at the Davos Forum this past week. Also on the program today, another mass shooting in California, bringing the total of 18 dead between the two. And in Arizona, Ruben Gallego, congressman, announces his run against the former Democrat Kristen Sinema. Florida Supreme Court upholds its early ban on abortions. And the Democratic Blue Dog Caucus splits over desire to rebrand.
Let them fight.
Exactly. EPA still struggling to recover from 1,200 scientists and policy experts exodus during the Trump years. Meanwhile, a former FBI head of Russian investigations arrested for working with Russia and Albania. Department of Justice to sue Google over antitrust violations in the ad market. Iowa passes a bill to pour money into private schools. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Tuesday. Joining me, as she does every day, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Newsday Tuesday.
Newsday Tuesday it is. But we actually have, we spoke to Ken Klippenstein just moments ago.
And he's newsy, though.
Yeah, he's newsy. And we're going to play that in just a bit. Want to get to the Ruben Gallego video. But I want to make sure that there's two stories that jump out at me. This one about the EPA story is not necessarily a news of the day story, although it just came out. It was a report on it that they are woefully behind on writing up all the new regulations that the Biden administration are calling for to deal with climate change. And remember, there is a clock on this that actually is not just tied to the Biden administration. You all remember that that CRA legislation, that law, the Congressional Review Act, which allows an incoming Congress to essentially overturn administrative orders that take place from a prior administration, and not only overturn them, but make them impossible to reestablish without two-thirds approval from Congress. Now, this is obviously, this is like a, this is a, I guess both parties want it, but it's particularly helpful to the Republicans because more often than not, you have regulations that are proffered by a Democratic presidency that Republicans perceive as infringing on corporate freedom to pollute and harm citizens and to hurt workers, et cetera, et cetera. There were 1,200 scientists and policy experts during the Trump administration that left the agency. You know, we've talked about this. We talked about this when Trump actually got into office. I think we spoke to Sam Bagenstos, who was with the Department of Justice during the Clinton years and then back again during the Obama years, and saw what the 8 years of the Bush administration did to the Department of Justice infrastructure. And this is a perfect example of how agencies get destroyed during a Republican administration that is, you know, particularly the Trump administration with Scott, I can't remember the
Pruitt,
who came from, I think it was Kansas, who's
Oklahoma,
whose primary function was to sue the EPA and keep them from imposing their regulations on his state. And so the loss of 1,200 people means that the EPA under Biden has actually prosecuted less environmental criminals, if you will, than under the Trump administration. Because these agencies, to a large extent, function on inertia and on their own sort of like, you know, their own sort of fiefdoms. And it's much easier to destroy than it is to build up. And it's much easier to drive people out of 1,200 people out of a job than it is to attract 1,200 people who have been there for years and have institutional memory, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, and this is something that's really important for people to understand. When you're voting for a president, you're not just voting for that person. You're not even voting for the people that they will necessarily appoint around them. You're voting for a broad and without a doubt insufficient in many instances, in most instances, but a broad mandate to maintain the functions of government. And this is inhibiting the good things that Biden wants to do in terms of the EPA. It's inhibiting the ability of the EPA to police, to provide enforcement, to write new chemical, chemical regulations, to do more research, et cetera, et cetera. And one statistic that I just found amazing. Staffing at the EPA peaked during in 2004, during the Bush administration. There were 17,611 employees. It was Whitman, right, from New Jersey, who I believe was the EPA chief in that first administration. And it just so happened that the EPA was just not a place that the Bush administration was looking to attack. They had a lot of other things going on at that time. They had to wage multiple wars and completely sell the American public on that. So their focus was not on that. 17,611 employees. There are 3,500 less employees now.
Oof. Wait, what's that figure?
17,611 in 2004. And 15,400 when Trump entered. And now there's 14,172. And so just, you know, I mean, think about the implications of losing that institutional knowledge. If you're running a business, 20% turnover is huge. But actually, it's attrition. I mean, there's not even been turnover. Those seats have not been filled again. And more than likely, you lost people who were just starting their careers there and decided, this is not going to be my career. Or people who were on the tail end of their careers who had all the institutional knowledge to train people, to figure out the easiest ways of implementing things. So this is what, you know, this is what happens during a a Republican administration. I mean, they were particularly hostile to the EPA.
And we saw it happen to the IRS too, right? Like we're living in the wake of that, and this is what's happening to the EPA in real time.
Over 10 years, real problems at the IRS. That has been also, I think, legislatively mandated in that they cut funding dramatically. But also things like Bureau of Land Management, they were dispersed, I think, out into the outside of Washington, and they forced a lot of people to move. So I imagine you had big numbers there. We should try and find maybe somebody who can speak to that. Maybe the Revolving Door Project. They may have a better sense of that. But, you know, it's very rare that you see, you know, that level of being kept track of just like what's happening to these agencies. The idea that we would have 20 years later, 20% less EPA staffing is absurd.
Given climate change.
Exactly.
I mean, the reason that was lower on the list of priorities for the Bush administration, among the thing, in addition to what you describe, is that people didn't have the broader awareness that they do now about climate change and what we need to do. And enforcement is
probably true.
Necessary.
It's probably true. And of course, largely speaking, you know, I think it just flew under the radar. There wasn't, you didn't have the 10 years of the Obama administration, which was, you know, inhibiting the growth of the oil and gas industry. Like you say, was not becoming sort of like a government policy, or understanding until that time. But, all right, let's get to this Gallego announcement against Sinema. Remember, it's largely understood that Kristen Sinema switched her party registration from Democrat to independent because she knew that she would lose in a Democratic primary. And now she is guaranteed a spot in the general election. And now the implicit threat from her is you can run a Democrat, but you may, or at least what she's, you know, going to argue, if not directly, at least implicitly, is you're going to split the vote and you're going to elect a Republican. So it's up to you, Democratic Party. Do you run a Democrat and split the vote and elect a Republican or not? Now, she also, the flip side of that is she doesn't have much of a constituency except for at Davos.
Oh, yeah. The mayor of Phoenix did some poll where and put it out there. I forget exactly what it was, completely unscientific, but he had like a 40-point lead on her. And that's not this candidate that's actually running. But it is interesting. I saw the Huffington Post wrote this up that the two major Democratic consultant groups that had been working with her previously have abandoned her in the last year. So that's at least some signal that institutional support is holding off, at least for now, to on supporting her from the though they usually support their incumbents, but there might be an exception for her.
Right. And technically speaking, she's not an incumbent. Now, we saw this with Joe Lieberman back in the day when he lost his primary and ended up running for, you know, Connecticut for Lieberman, that there was still a lot of establishment Democratic support for him. So, you know, we're 2 years out. Gallego's getting into it early. I think only Manchin and Hickenlooper at this point have said that they would support Sinema, largely irrelevant. And I think my guess is if Gallego shows enough strength, then early, then you're going to see the Democratic establishment be supportive of him over Sinema, or at least maybe not weigh in favor of Sinema. Maybe there's some outside expenditure group right now, if they're smart, who are going to start to basically try and woo support from Republicans to Sinema so that ticket splitting happens at the very least equally on that side as well, mm-hmm. which is conceivable, right? I mean, she's certainly been positioning herself in that way. But here's Gallego's opening a video. And this is, you know, I will confess to not being super familiar with Gallego. I mean, I think largely he's been, at least in terms of when we've heard from him, has been progressive, at least in the things that he's been talking about for the most part. This is a pretty strong video, though.
Growing up poor, the only thing I really had was the American dream. An opportunity. It's the one thing that we give every American, no matter where they are born in life. It was actually something to believe in and to fight for.
The odds that a single, an immigrant mom with a Latino boy, statistically, I was never supposed to end up even in college. I slept on a floor and a couch and a roll-on mat. Hearing her cry, like, every night, being stressed out about how she's going to raise, like, four kids on a secretary's salary, you know, with an absent father.
Fue una experiencia muy dura.
Having to step up and be a father figure to my three sisters and skipping my teenage years influenced me a lot.
When you're poor, you really need a belief and a hope in a better future.
Hey, homie. Rita, you want to make you one?
And what helps to do that is when you have other people believe with you. My family, who didn't laugh at me when I told them I'm going to Harvard. Had teachers, did everything they could to make sure that it was possible. I had a government that believed in kids like me. I really did feel that I owed the country something. And we got sent to Iraq.
Losing all my friends, consistently being shot at, and people trying to blow you up all the time.
You never really fully come back from a war. You're not the same person.
Fighting through PTSD. There were some very low moments in my life. But I still didn't give up hope and push forward.
I found a new way to keep serving.
Hey! You're the first group of people that are hearing this, besides my family. I will be challenging Kyrsten Sinema for the United States Senate, and I need all of your support.
Most families feel that they are one or two paychecks away from going under. That is not the way that we should be living in this country. The rich and the powerful, they don't need more advocates. It's the people that are still trying to decide between groceries and utilities that needs a fighter for them. There is no lobbyist for working families. We could argue different ways about how to do it, but at the core, if you're more likely to be meeting with the powerful than the powerless, you're doing this job incorrectly. I'm sorry that politicians have let you down, but I'm going to change that.
I'm Ruben Gallego. I'm running to be the senator of Arizona.
Because you deserve somebody fighting for you and fighting with you every day to make sure you have the same chance al sueño americano.
That's pretty strong opening video in terms of knocking off Kyrsten Sinema. And again, getting out there very early because there will be no, let me put it this way. There could be Democrats running in the primary, but this is sort of the silent primary, right? And this is also a sort of a different thing where he is trying to compete against the idea of Sinema running as a third party candidate.
And the idea of her generally, the language at the end of that ad where he talks about, you know, there's no lobbyists for working families. And if you're meeting with the powerful and not meeting with the powerless, which is, by the way, what everybody says about her, is that she's essentially closed the door on anybody trying to reach her office. Groups that aren't radical by any sense, she's not picking up their phone calls. And then juxtapose what he has to say there with the image of her high-fiving at Davos, literally meeting with the powerful.
Yeah.
That I thought that was a very, very well done, subtle jab and differentiator. And it's good to highlight his actual story because it makes sense within the context of what he's trying to the contrast he's trying to draw with her.
All right, I'm going to take a moment to read some sponsor stuff, and then we'll be talking to Ken Klippenstein. He is the investigative reporter at The Intercept. on the five most creepy moments from Davos. But first, some breaking news. They have found more classified documents, this time at the home of Mike Pence.
Interesting.
So there you have it.
I thought VPs couldn't do that.
They also have the ability to make things unclassified. I mean, look, you know, the bottom line is there's too many documents that are classified, period. There's always been the case. The real issue remains. And I guess presumably, I don't know. I don't know how this was. They found them, though. Pence claimed that he did not have any documents at his house, apparently, because he had been out there slamming Biden for having them and saying, as vice president, I didn't have any. And then I think what they said is like, yeah, well, maybe we should just check. And they did.
Before I say that, let me just
just after I say that, we should check. And they did. But look, the bottom line is the problem with what Trump did.
Yeah.
And we said this contemporaneously, was not that he may have mistakenly taken classified documents or even purposefully taken classified documents. It's that he refused to give them back when yes. the archives said, you've taken so many, we know you have them. And then he gave some back and they hid the other group of
exactly.
documents they didn't want to get back. I mean, that
we at the Majority Report don't really care about the content that much of the classified documents.
I mean, it depends on what it is, but
they broadly classify a lot of things.
Yes.
I mean, so it's the fact that it was yet another instance of him trying to evade the law and lie.
Yes. I mean, it's obstruction is the big issue. I mean, that at this point, anyways, we don't know what he was doing with that stuff, that he clearly was acting in a way that he wanted to retain it for some reason.
Just satisfying my curiosity.
I was going to put it up in the special classified suite at Mar-a-Lago. It's a theme thing.
Yeah.
We're going to get a lot more money. All right. A couple of words from our producers. Who doesn't love a good cha-ching? That's the sound of yet another sale on Shopify. And this is your year to forget about those run-of-the-mill resolutions. Start your own New Year's revolution. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. We use it at the Majority Report for our merch store. And now I'm actually thinking, we should be upping things. We should be just selling everything out of there.
Yeah.
We should also get the Emma Majority Report shirts back.
Yeah. Majority Report.
But Shopify is the only way that we could have gotten a merch store up and running because it is super easy. It allows you, if we want to coordinate selling online and let's say we start doing a lot of live shows and we're selling our merch. Well, you can integrate that, which is huge for other businesses because nobody sells just in their store now and nobody sells just online. You got to do both. Shopify covers every sales channel. Doesn't matter if it's an in-person system to an all-in-one e-commerce platform. It also lets you go across social media marketplaces like TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram. I just found this out. I didn't realize it, but you can buy stuff within Instagram.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Did Mila buy something?
I have to be walked through everything now.
Yeah.
It's really ridiculous. Yeah, Mila's doing that constantly, but I didn't really pick up on it. And the great thing about Shopify, 24/7 help. They have an extensive business course library. Shopify, here to support your success every step of the way. Check it out. You can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/majority, all lowercase. Shopify.com/majority, a $1 per month trial period. Go to shopify.com/majority to take your business to the next level today. Shopify, shopify.com/majority. Also, you're running that business from your home. Maybe you're sending out DVDs. because you're trying to convince people to do your podcast, or you're doing your fulfillment, or maybe you're like my daughter and you're running a small consignment store out of your apartment. Basically, the other day, I went through this with her again. Like, she's like, I make a lot of money. And I'm like, you don't make a lot of money. You just keep selling the clothes that I buy you.
Yeah, right. I mean, she does make money, though. That's the yes,
but that's like saying, like, I'm making money, like on my birthday, I'm making money by getting presents.
I mean, she has an entrepreneurial spirit.
But the point is, stamps.com allows you to print your own postage right from your home or your office within minutes of signing up. They even send you a free scale, so you have everything you need to get started. And that saves a lot of money. You don't have to worry about finding the fastest or the cheapest shipping solutions, because they exist right in wherever your computer is with Stamps.com. Stamps.com has partnerships with the U.S. Postal Service and UPS for unbeatable rates that are up to 86% off. And if you sell products online, Stamps.com seamlessly connects with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Plus, if you need a package pickup, you can easily schedule it through your Stamps.com dashboard. Start the new year by saving serious money on mailing and shipping. Get started with Stamps.com today. Sign up with the promo code MajorityReport for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. There are no long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, enter the code MajorityReport. And lastly, this is I've had a weird trajectory with Nutrafol. They sponsored this program, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And I was trying to see if Michael wanted to use the product, because mm-hmm. he was going a little bit, you know, bald on top.
He was balding. Yep.
He was balding. I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying that now.
Yeah, I'm sure he'd be happy. But,
And then we started to, we started to advertise for it again. And you had told me that story that you had a friend who had a really good experience with Nutrafol.
Yeah. She had some health issues and she was losing her hair, and Nutrafol she used, and it completely helped it.
And Nutrafol is apparently the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement. It is clinically shown to improve your hair growth, thickness, and visible scalp coverage for men and women. And then I knew somebody who knew, apparently, the guy who invented this. And he apparently, like, met his wife because she had some hair issues.
Ah.
Went to see him back before the thing had started, and it really helped her out. And then I found some of the old bottles that we had of Nutrafol here, and I started to take it just because I wanted to see, like, we're going to advertise, and they were expired. But I don't know if it was helping, because I was starting to feel like I was getting a little anyways. But I ended up getting more, and I'm taking it because it's a hair growth supplement, but it deals with stress, hormones, nutrition, metabolism, aging, and lifestyle factors that might be impacting your hair. Has unique formulas for men and women to provide exactly what they need based on their biology and age. Every formula is physician formulated, again, using natural medical grade ingredients for reliable results. In clinical studies, 72% of men saw more scalp coverage. 86% of women saw improved hair growth after 6 months. Nutrafol is trusted and recommended by more than 3,000 top doctors. And you don't get the, you know, side effects you get from, like, the different chemicals that they sell for the other hair products. You can grow thicker, healthier hair and support our show by going to Nutrafol.com and entering the promo code TMR to save $15 off your first month subscription. This is their best offer anywhere. It's only available to U.S. customers for a limited time. Plus, free shipping on every order. Get $15 off at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code TMR. You can obviously find this in the podcast and YouTube description or at majority.fm. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ken Klippenstein, investigative reporter at The Intercept, author of his self-titled newsletter on Substack about the creepiest moments from this year's Davos. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Pleasure to welcome back to the program Ken Klippenstein. He's an investigative journalist with The Intercept and also the proprietor of his self-titled Substack.
Yeah.
Ken.Klippenstein.substack. Right? Is that it, Ken?
That's correct.
Okay, great.
Self-titled albums are usually the best ones.
Right.
So that's
eponymous.
Right?
Eponymous, is that what we call it? Eponymous.
There you go.
Thank you.
Good work.
All right, so Ken, you just got back from Davos.
Yeah, got my speaking fee. I'm got my nice office now, so I'm ready to go.
That's great. How was the food?
You know, it wasn't up to snuff, but looked the other way this time.
So you did a couple of reports from there. One of them being the five creepiest moments at Davos. Maybe let's go through those moments. But I also want to get a broader sense of what was happening there. Have you been there before?
No, I have not, and I actually wasn't there this time. To be clear, but the differentiating factor is I actually watched a lot of these panels, which to my astonishment, nobody really does. And sort of my reason for following these things, for having this masochistic streak to want to watch these panels in full, was the fact that there's so much speculation around what it is, and frankly, a lot of really fanciful ideas, let's say, around what takes place at these things. I mean, I saw this whole false dichotomy of on the one side, there are this kind of fever dreams, particularly on the far right, that you know, they're eating babies, or that and this isn't a joke. There was actually a Twitter user who posted video of a bunch of like Matrix movie style baby incubator pods that Davos was apparently producing and preparing for the rest of the world. So that's obviously not true. It's not happening. But then on the other side, there's a sort of counter response to that, which is to say, oh, anything that's critical of Davos or skeptical of it, that's a conspiracy theory. And that's not really true either. It's correct that what Davos is doing, you know, it's this event in the Swiss Alps at a ski resort where a bunch of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, central bankers, heads of state, economic ministers come together and kind of discuss their sort of macroeconomic plans for the future. And so I just wanted to like actually look at and see, okay, what are they actually saying as distinct from these two tendencies to say there's nothing to see there. And also there's baby incubators. And that was sort of the impetus for my reporting.
How do you know that there wasn't that many people streaming it? Just because they do their numbers live? Because I wonder if the idea of that place is less about other people seeing it and more about the sort of the networking that goes on there and the panels being, an excuse for everyone to come and network on some level.
Oh, you're totally right. And one of the panels that featured a bunch of central bankers, including the former Treasury Secretary, Larry Summers, the moderator commented on how she was like, it's interesting to see central bankers kind of speaking behind the scenes in the office and seeing how the sausage is made. And you're absolutely right. There's, you know, not just networking. It seems like there's like, you know, substantive discussion around policy that takes place outside of the publicly recorded meetings. But even those public recorded meetings, the extent of the reporting you'll find on it is sort of the business press writing, oh, they were talking about exciting new innovative ideas. And there's not really any reporting of like, here's how this affects an ordinary person and what this says about what the sort of macroeconomic vision for the next 5 years is. And so that was kind of what I endeavor to try to do in watching these things.
It also feels like sort of, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, this is where they have a conference. They invite all these lawmakers to like state lawmakers from around the country to get together. They come up with model legislation. Then it goes back. It's almost as if it's like it's not conspiracy, but there is a quality of this where they're getting together these really powerful people, both within and without government, getting together, setting an agenda, and then they go back to their respective countries and try and impose that agenda.
Totally. You know, in one of the panels on central banking, they were discussing what the interest rate hikes are going to be going forward, and you know whether they're really going to try for a lower inflation rate, which is kind of a Faustian bargain, because the more you hike up interest rates, you know, that does bring down inflation, but it also brings up unemployment. It was interesting to see them all kind of defer to Summers, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary, and how much these guys coordinate these things. And it was said explicitly at one point in the panel that I think the expression they used is when the United States sneezes, the world gets a cold. The idea sort of being like we are the bellwether for what's all the other central banks in Europe and the rest of the world are going to do. So yeah, the coordination, they're pretty open about that. I mean, it's not a conspiracy theory if they're just openly saying, yeah, we're going to get together and plan these things and coordinate them.
The conspiracy theory element is, yeah, the babies in incubators, which is obviously like the anti-Semitic tropes about them controlling the world. That's what that originates from. But the reality is that, I mean, some of the people you have in your piece, it's Larry Summers, but also we covered this on our show, Kyrsten Sinema, Joe Manchin, who openly served those same people. And even, you know, people like Henry Kissinger were there, all hobnobbing behind the scenes, like probably coordinating, as you say. But there's going to be some level of stuff that you can glean from the panels, even if a lot of it's still behind the scenes.
Totally. And they sort of let their hair down, too. Because right. I really believe this. People are just so bored by the kind of exterior of it, like all of this glad handing and then, you know, $5 words and everything, that people sort of check out. And I think that if anything, is the biggest element of secrecy to this, is just the assurance that the only people that are going to cover it are going to be the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, the Financial Times, and they're going to cover it in a certain way that they don't really have to worry about things.
All right, well, let's go through some of these. And we should say Kissinger wasn't there either, right? Wasn't he zoomed in? I mean,
zoomed in, yes.
Yeah, oh, zoomed in, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. I think if there aren't countries where Kissinger isn't allowed to go without getting arrested, I think that's a mistake. But I would also impose, if that is the case, I would also impose that on Larry Summers. I really don't think that he should be allowed to go out anywhere in public and talk about these things, because his agenda is... I mean, it's a Faustian bargain from our perspective, maybe, but I think it's really just a bargain for some of, you know, someone like Larry Summers, with the idea of like, well, we get to take down inflation and we get to weaken, you know, workers. Their wage strength. So that's really just a bargain. It's not even,
a win-win for them.
I don't think, yeah. Or a Sumerian.
The moderator asked at one point, it was a central banker, I think from, Switzerland. And she says, you know, when you're hiking these rates, do you guys think about the unemployment? And he explicitly said to her, it was like, no, we're looking at inflation. You just said like, that's not really our job. Like, we don't really care about that. And if you look at, to give some context, in Europe, they don't even have the dual mandate that we have here in the United States for both inflation and unemployment. So he just said that explicitly, which I was sort of amazed by.
Yeah. They're that's what they're getting together for. That's the, I guess, the Davos agenda, as it were. You start your piece off talking about like one of the things that was a big point of discussion was retirement, and the idea of like, I couldn't quite make it out. Is the idea that they're trying to figure out a new way of providing retirement, or they're trying to figure out a new way to eliminate retirement on some level and just have people work until, you know, they're dead. Essentially.
Well, as they described, they want to disrupt retirement. So they have all these euphemisms that half of the work of this piece were just designed to decode and explain people what it meant. But this was a recurring motif at a lot of these meetings they're like, oh my God, people are growing older now and they're not dying as young as they used to. How are we going to get more productivity out of them? These are good years that we can be putting them to work. So in this one segment under, it was part of, it's titled like the Davos Agenda, They're explicitly saying, you know, like, how are we going to change people's attitudes around work so that it's destigmatized for older people to go back to work? And of course, they cast it as kind of this empowering thing that, you know, now grandma has more freedom in life and she can enjoy community that work affords and all these different things. But yeah, the line they're using to pitch it is people are living longer, so therefore changes have to be made and grandma's got to go back to work, kind of thing.
With Manchin's idea of a committee to look at this stuff, I mean, that's sort of like what we would refer to. The Simpson-Bowles committee was certainly about, it was like one of the ways you're going to enjoy your retirement is more cat food for older folks in lieu of actual food. All right, let's talk about the panel on quiet quitting. My understanding is that's not really a thing that exists so much is like there are people who are quitting, but they're not necessarily like quiet quitting, or maybe there's this notion of just people are just less willing to take crap from their bosses.
Or that it's a new phenomenon. I mean, in your piece, you talk about the movie Office Space, Ken, right? Like this trope of people essentially checking out from work, it's not something new.
Right. Yeah. This, again, to give you guys some context, another recurring theme is this anxiety these elites seem to have around the post-pandemic environment, which I think there is a lot of evidence to suggest that the pandemic and just the, like, you know, death and suffering that entailed caused people to ask questions about, you know, what am I willing, what do I want from life? Sort of thing. And they explicitly say that that's causing problems for them and that we've got to find a way to give workers a sense of meaning. And of course, that doesn't happen to include allowing them to, you know, enjoy more time in their life to pursue that meaning. That's like give them the sense of meaning through work and the generation of revenue. And so it becomes this sort of HR thing of like, how do we make people feel like the work that they're doing gives them the sense of meaning that, you know, family, community, play, reading, whatever might give them in the context of showing up for work. And the sort of consensus around this is not just that quiet quit is happening. There was disagreement over, as you guys say, whether it's always been there, but I don't think anyone thinks that it's, I don't think anyone at these panels thought that it wasn't happening. It seems like this acute anxiety. It's almost like a mass hysteria sort of thing among these elites. They're really worried that they're losing revenue and people could be producing more. And there's, you know, the way I always call it, it's like Havana syndrome for corporate elites.
Right,
they're all
right.
Convinced of this thing.
Well, that it also seems to be like part of the fear of workers gaining more power,
totally.
Which is a real, I think, sort of phenomena, at least, you know, has at least up to this point. In the wake of COVID, and part of that is at the very least is that we know there's at least a 500,000, maybe more people who should be in the workforce, but are now dead because of COVID. And so they're not there. And that increases the bargaining power of a lot of people, you know, of a lot of wage workers, I guess.
Exactly. The euphemism they use for that, and this came up again and again, is tight labor market. We have an extremely tight labor market. And the reasons are, both that people have just died, that a lot of older people are leaving the workforce and the younger population isn't populous enough to replace them at that rate. And then in addition to all that, there's a lot of people that there's mounting evidence that people who didn't die from COVID but had a particularly serious bout are effectively disabled in various ways. And so they don't have the capacity to work at the level that they were working at before. So all of this contributes to a better employment environment for workers, and they're really worried about that. They really don't like that because the consequence of that is that people can start getting concessions and asking for things and you know, be allowed to work remotely and not be required to show up, all sorts of things. I did a story recently on an investor call where there was some big company that was saying, a recession could, quote, put the employer back in the driver's seat. The idea being, you know, these uppity workers, have conditions such that they can really pick employers and things. And so now employers have to try to figure out how to respond to that. So yeah, that is an intense and acutely felt anxiety on their part that I think is leading to a lot. If you look at mass hysteria, it doesn't come out of nowhere. It's often a reflection of the culture's anxiety about various things. And in this case, I think it is this relatively, compared to recent times, tight labor market that exists.
Well, there was one solution to this that you cite in that panel of quiet quitting, which I've already adopted here on the show, which is instead of sending emails or texts to the workers here, I send them a personal video message so that I can get their emotion and nuance instead of them reading an email. So I mean, we can take a survey to see how it's working out here.
That was really looking at my facial expressions.
That was really the consensus is, you know, well, we got to give them better culture. What doesn't really come up is, you know, wages and time off and just the material stuff that people might want. It's how do we shore up the culture to make people feel better and head off this, you know, newfound confidence on the part of workers over the last couple of years.
It's kind of like the new version of when tech companies were putting beanbag chairs in every in their office spaces and being like, this is a new fun work environment.
I know someone who was working at a place where they built their own furniture. That's that's part of the... All right. So we spoke about cinema and Manchin high-fiving each other over, you know, the lack of filibuster reform. And they were sitting on a panel with Chris Coons as well. And, I mean, how much was your sense of there being there a sort of like just strictly a fundraising issue for them? Because really, more than any other senators in the Senate, they were inhibiting the most worker empowering agendas that could have been there. Like, you know, the Build Back Better in particular would have really, I think, strengthened workers in many ways. You know, things like parental leave, paid sick leave, child tax credit extension. I mean, all of these things that commodify different parts of our lives strengthen workers because they're not threatened with their kids having no health insurance, or they have more, you know, money in the bank, or they have mandated paid sick leave and parental leave. How much of like what they're there for is your sense is like they're just fundraising because they've lost on some level these are their constituents.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening. If you look at both Manchin's numbers in West Virginia, they are cratering. They're disastrously bad. And Sinema's numbers are very bad among her own party as well. Ruben Gallego, progressive Democratic representative, just announced his campaign for Senate, which he'll be running against Sinema. So, you know, having lost a lot of people power for their positions that were amenable to corporate interests in the context of the entire last congressional session, you know, their only move at this point is just to grab as much money as they possibly can from these corporate donors that are going to see an image like them high-fiving and I suppose people like us getting angry about it and say, wow, this person really must be on our side. We better, you know, give them a bunch of money. And if you look at the amount of money that I can't remember what the group is, I think it's called Third Way, has raised for Sinema, it's really extraordinary. So it's you know, I wouldn't necessarily look at the sort of dire polling picture and necessarily assume that they're not going to be able to at least mitigate that with just this flood of corporate cash that they have going to their coffers because of their conduct over the last 2 years.
At the very least, that's their strategy. I mean, yeah, we can't anticipate how well it's going to work. And I think you're right. I think it's, you know, you put in $50, $100 million worth of ads, you know, that she's going to be able to start running now for the next 2 years. That's definitely going to help her. And at the very least, it's going to put a scare into the Democrats that they're going to split the vote. But I don't know. Gallego came out that opening video he did to announce his campaign is pretty impressive. So we'll see about that. Let's talk about this idea about protectionism that came up and the idea of bringing back jobs. It was interesting because, you know, when Chris Coons is the voice of reason, you know, you got a problem.
Yeah, he was sort of the dove in this meeting, which was sort of extraordinary. God.
Yeah, tell us about it.
Okay, so I'll just read you a quote. One of the president of the World Economic Forum, which organizes Davos, Borja Brenda, I don't know if I'm saying it right, he said, quote, "If we get too much into this notion of friendshoring or more protectionist measures, we can shave off a lot of growth globally." And just his tone at that point was kind of like, oh, God, like that, we can't let that happen. And so he says, "How far will the U.S. go in friendshoring?" I'll explain that in a second, making sure that things go to Mexico and countries that you're allied with. And so he's trying to take the temperature of Coons as a, you know, Democratic U.S. senator, get a sense from him what the chamber is going to do over the next 2 years in this regard. So protection.
And we should also say Coons is probably the closest to Biden in the Senate of any other senator. I mean, he was like an on the trail surrogate for him. They are very close.
Yeah. So protectionism is kind of the opposite of free trade. It's the idea that you're going to protect domestic industry with tariffs on foreign imports and things. Basically, the idea being so that you can have industry in your own country, so you're not having to import, you know, slave labor products from China or whatever. In its best case. And then the sort of counter argument to that is, oh, well, you know, we need to have open markets and trade with other countries and everything. And so friendshoring is the idea that not just are you going to bring production back to the U.S., but that you would bring production back to your region, so neighboring countries. And over the course of this panel, they explicitly say, you know, Coons points out, you know, if we friendshore, bring jobs back to El Salvador, Mexico, Honduras, so on and so forth, not only will that, you know, have a positive effect on the U.S. economy, that's going to decrease the economic crisis that they're experiencing there. And that's going to decrease the sort of undocumented migration that the right wing claims to care so much about, because people will actually be able to stay in those countries and not have to, flee potentially violence or horrible economic situations. And it was just amazing to me to see the amount of awareness that Coons had about these things. He said, quote, "The reach and scope of globalization that have caused a backlash in many of our countries, a populist backlash, certainly in the United States, needs to be addressed." So to me, that sounds like he's saying political extremism is connected to the economic environment that you know, our free trade apparatus has created. So I think, oh, wow, that's a big admission. So is he going to be for protectionism? And then he goes on to say, nearshoring would improve the job opportunities in Central America. But ultimately, he says, I don't think the changes will be as robust as people are projecting. And he says, we will continue to have an open economy, to be committed to free trade, and see the robust value that globalization has brought to the world, as well as to many of our people. So it's kind of like, here's all the great things of protectionism, but yeah, we're not doing it.
Well, I mean, there's an interesting tension here because, one, the COVID made it clear that that from a logistics standpoint, we need shorter supply lines for some key things, right? We can't rely on all these things coming from China. And everything about, you know, sort of like bringing jobs back to Central America will ease the situation for people there. And presumably there's other issues too, but presumably make it easier, make the lives of people easier there, and will diminish the pressure of immigrants coming north. But the other issue here is that in fully sort of divesting on some level from China, we're also setting up a conflict with China because we have decoupled our fates from each other. And this is one of the things that, you know, sort of the line that it feels like Biden is walking here, and it's unclear on which side of it he's falling, because the thing that has always sort of like maintained, I guess, the lack of aggression between us and China was that we're screwed if China's screwed, and China's screwed if we're screwed. Right. But if we decouple that sort of fate from each other, that it makes, you know, sort of like an actual conflict more possible. So it's interesting to see how they're talking around these things. But that takes us to Henry Kissinger speaking on peace. I mean,
what do you
Sam,
say?
Sam's doing a talk later on why floral scents are really good.
Yeah,
and all.
I mean, this is. Was this like this entertainment? Like they couldn't get they couldn't get the comedian they wanted for that night, and so they just brought this sketch in, or what?
Well, and you said before that there's an element of networking here, and the amount of just bootlicking. I mean, I expect that watching something like this, but that this stuff surprised even me. So to give you the quote, it's not just the thing is called the title of the event had the words War and Peace in it, but if you look at the comments, it was just so ingratiating. So he says, quote, the moderator, who's a Harvard professor of government, says to Kissinger, you've, quote, you've drilled down deeper on the challenges of War and Peace than any other person I can identify. Which I had to pause because it's like, that's one way to put it. And
then well, he goes on to say, he's half right, right?
Well,
the war part.
Well, he's right about the peace thing. It's just that he's drilled down and then undermined it. I mean, so he really... He really knows what could bring about peace. He just decided, like, we're not going to go in that direction.
Mm. Right. He goes on to say, Kissinger has continued thinking in the time since, you know, the Vietnam War, has continued thinking and writing about the challenges of building a peaceful world order, which is just a turn of phrase I dearly loved.
Yeah. And what did Kissinger have to say? I mean, the guy's old.
100 yeah. years old?
It was just a lot of pablum. I thought Noam Chomsky put it well when he said he seems like a sort of mid-level manager that was able to conceal his vacuity with pretentious verbiage. That was exactly what this entire talk was. And some backing off of previous remarks that he had made on the need to negotiate with Russia on Ukraine and apologize and saying, no, I support this war, blah, blah, blah. So that was sort of the extent of the insight from Mr. Kissinger.
The idea that guy lives to 99 is really,
I mean, how are him and Dick Cheney still kicking? Dick Cheney,
they're gonna outlive all of us.
I know,
yeah, they're gonna be like head in a jar and we'll all be gone.
Oh, great.
If you ever wanted proof that there is no God, there it is. And then the last one, it seems like, all has been forgiven in terms of Saudi Arabia. I mean, I guess that's the, like, you know, nothing like a tightening of the world's oil supply to put Saudi Arabia back in everyone's good graces.
Yeah, it was interesting. Even some in the mainstream were sort of laughing at how ridiculous this was. It was political reporter Alex Ward called it, quote, this is basically an infomercial for Saudi Arabia, which is not an exaggeration at all. So the title's the event was called Saudi Arabia's Transformation in a Changing Global Context. And the entire thing is just a tongue washing of this plan that the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who the CIA says ordered the killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, he has this political plan called Vision 2030. Which remains largely a vision. It hasn't really been realized despite the last several years of his, endlessly talking about this. But in that vision, the idea is essentially we're going to develop this country so that it's not just a gas station. And, I don't think there's much evidence for that. Any of that has happened, but the entire panel is, I think it's a top IMF official talking about how wonderful this plan is. The head of a think tank called the Atlantic Council, which here in Washington is very powerful think tank in terms of formulating the kind of private consensus on foreign policy. The head of that think tank, Fred Kemp, he just at the beginning of the entire thing, he calls Saudi Arabia's Minister of Finance, who's also present, a quote rock star. And he says, I hope that's an accepted thing to call someone in Saudi Arabia, but you really are so highly respected. You really are very respected by all of your peers. I mean, it was just, and then it cuts to the Minister of Finance just beaming. It was disgusting. The entire thing is like this. And at the same time, sort of humorous thing happening, this head of the Atlantic Council, Fred Kemp, he had written an op-ed for CNBC defending, this is true, the UN's climate summit chief they put in charge of the next COP23 climate summit, the CEO of the UAE state oil company. So this is one of the biggest oil producers on the earth. Their state oil company is now in charge of the UN's climate summit. And the head of the Atlantic Council was in this op-ed saying how that's fine and there's no problem and these activists need to shut up because it's really not that big of a deal. At the exact same time that this conference is happening, CNBC has to append an update talking about his conflicts of interest with these oil countries because the Atlantic Council gets so much money from them, just to give viewers a sense of the context in which Fred Kemp is speaking here.
Wow. And we should say, too, that I think that, you know, like it is
It just shows you, like, you know, Thomas Friedman still, in many ways, rules our world. Because I still remember when he was just praising MBS for all of the progressive things he was doing with Saudi Arabia. Women have driver's licenses now, and that was, I guess that was, I don't know, 7-8 years ago now. But it all comes back around. It seems like they have won out. What just overall, any other thoughts about Davos? What next time you got to go, dude?
Yeah, I want to accost them in the.
You won't get anywhere near them. You won't get anywhere near them. But I mean, any other sort of like overall sense of what was going on there?
I would say the biggest picture to take back is their discussion around inflation. They are firm on 2%, even though we've seen inflation decrease every month for the last 6 months. A very positive picture. And I don't think any reason to be certainly afraid of it increasing. And there's every reason to believe that it will continue to decrease. They were not impressed by that. Every one of the central bankers, from Larry Summers to some of these European bankers, are saying it's a firm 2%, and it doesn't matter how close we get to it. As long as it's not 2%, we are going to continue not just hiking rates, but we need to avoid the sort of they call it reckless fiscal spending, which is basically, you know, any sort of social program is going to fall under that. They are really firm on that. So I was sort of taken aback by how unimpressed they are at the progress that is already taken place on inflation.
Do they ever talk timeline? Or is it just like there is no, like, it's not sufficient that it would take a year, let's say?
No. Summers himself has described 5 years of increased unemployment to fight this thing. So they think in terms far beyond the sort of quarterly thing that a lot of businesses do. And they made it clear in these talks, they said, as long as it takes, because that exact question was raised. How long are you thinking? As long as it takes. And so I really, and they were explicit, you know, central banks are not political sort of elected institutions. They're supposed to be insulated from what they would call, you know, political meddling. What they mean is democracy. And so, very open about that. They don't care what the response from the public is going to be. It's full bore, continued austerity to the extent that they're going to be able to get away with it.
I can't help but think of an interview we did a couple of weeks ago with Clara Mattai, who made this point that austerity is not is an important component of capitalism. It is built into the system. And Ken Klippenstein, thank you so much for your time today. Folks can check out your Substack and your reporting at The Intercept. Really appreciate it.
Great to be with you guys.
Thanks, Ken.
Thanks, guys.
We are back. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland, The Majority Report. Wrapping up, folks. Going to head into the fun half of the program. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only support the free show, you get the free show free of commercials, and you get the fun half of the program. Plus, you get amenities on the app. You can IM us. The app is free, but for members, you can IM us. You can do deep search on the app. You can get the app at majorityapp.com. Like I say, free, but if you're a member, has added bonus features. Also, don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. Check out our merch store at, what is it?
Shop.majorityreportradio.com.
Shop.majorityreportradio.com. I'm really on top of this stuff.
You are.
I'm so on top of this. Check it out today. And Emma.
Yeah.
What's happening on ESPN?
Well, very, very busy times over at ESPN, given the fact that we're in the middle of the NFL playoffs. Lots of storylines to break down. Bradley and I just broke down the divisional weekend, and we also took some calls, which was fun. So check that out, youtube.com/ESPN show.
Matt, what's happening on the Matt Leck media front?
Yeah, tonight, Andrew Perez of The Lever, we're talking about Buttigieg and Pfizer doing pay ads for at Semaphore to whitewash their record. So check that out, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Buttigieg?
Buttigieg.
That's one of your verbal tics. You also Buttigieg. Like you say
that's because you know why? Because I had a friend
Jeffrey Epstein like every time too.
Epstein?
Yeah, it's Epstein.
That doesn't matter.
But like, the Weinsteins. I used to call them the Weinsteins, and they're the Weinsteins. So it's like,
oh no, maybe.
And we don't even know.
One.
We don't even know which Ken Klippenstein wouldn't even correct us on the which way to say his.
Yeah,
name, but
I don't know.
But yeah, Buttigieg. I say that way because my friend was big into Pete in 2015, and I'm like, this guy's a nerd. But that's how we understood his name. Mm. But Buttigieg, sure.
All that and more on the fun half today, folks. You can join us. 646-257-3920 is the number, or you can via the app. I feel like I had some like other thing to say. I don't know. Also, we have a special in-guest studio, one of our long-time IMers. In-guest studio?
In-studio guest.
What's studio's not in the guest. I didn't realize that.
As long as I get all the words out, it doesn't matter the specific order. That's not going to get caught up in the
it's like
sort
a Jackson
of,
Pollock of language.
Sorry, right? I'm not kowtowing to the establishment, Matt, and their whole system of the way that like objects before verbs
agreed.
Or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Whoa.
Grammar is authoritarian.
Wow.
But what is your IM handle?
Well, he's shifted over the years. It was Fred at Con College, and then it was Fred formerly from Con College, and then it was like Fred in Korea.
Yeah, I think for a short period of time.
Now, like, what do you go by now?
I think I went back to Fred formerly
at Con College. Con College. There he is. But now, Fred currently in studio.
Studio Fred, yeah.
Folks, also. One thing that we're going to be talking about, like, look, you know, there's more important stuff than this, but there's probably no more enjoyable stuff than this. That is the Crowder Daily Wire thing. And one of my biggest fears about it, honestly, would be that this thing would end without some really personal dirt on some of the players not coming out. And I am encouraged because it appears like at least it's floating around out there and there's threats.
Oh, my, like literal blackmail threats by Candace Owens. It's fun for the whole family.
It's going to be great for
That's
everybody.
Beautiful.
It's really because, you know, one of the things about these people in this world, I get the sense. They don't come to these like jobs in a straight line. And I am sure there's going to be stuff that I think they all have skeletons in their closets. And so it's going to be pretty great. And we will talk about that in the fun half. Again, 646-257-3920. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
see white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Okay, I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on!
To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.